This show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
I'll look at the cover.
I'm up for it, Phil. I'll read any piece of shit comic.
Yeah, you're always
up. I can find it.
And that seems like a good beginning for episode 334 of Indie Comic Book Noise. Welcome, gang. Steve Raker here, along with
Phil and Andrew.
I'm Kevin.
And Kevin. I'll speak for them.
This is the totally independent podcast that is sponsored by nobody. But you can look to our gracious hosts over at comicbooknoise.com and the deliberatenoisenetwork.com. Thanks, Derek, for giving us an opportunity here. We're usually the Marvel Noise guys, but this is our opportunity to talk about indie books, use adult language, so be prepared. We've got a Facebook page that you could check out, and we've got a forum over on the 11 o'clock comics boards. We have, you can find us on Twitter, and you can even leave us an iTunes review. Why not?
Yes, I agree. iTunes reviews are awesome. Thank everyone who's listened and also contributed via iTunes comments or just taken the time to listen to our thoughts.
Before we go around the round table here and shoot out some indie books that we've been reading, since our last episode, we were solicited by a couple of folks trying to get their books out through fan funding platforms, and I thought we could just quickly mention those. One is Venus as a Boy, that is a Indiegogo campaign. And this is like a really colorful, I think maybe even would work better as a webcomic-y kind of a thing. It's very kinetic, almost like Ren and Stimpy-ishy kinds of page layouts and character designs and stuff. But very colorful. You could check those out. They have a Facebook page, Venus as a Boy, and the Indiegogo campaign. The other is Primal the Jungle Girl, and that has a Facebook page and is going to be a Kickstarter in March. I'm a sucker for Jungle Girl comics, that's for sure, and the coloring and some of the art samples that were sent by the artist Eric Allen Nelson looks pretty interesting, so I'm going to stick around and see what that campaign looks like on Kickstarter in March. Primal with a Y.
I wonder if he's related to Michael Allen Nelson, the comic book writer.
Yes. I was also thinking about that. And wasn't there an old like Sega Genesis Primal video game or something? Anyhow.
The author is Marcelo Bravo. All right, so I've talked enough. What do you guys been
I wonder doing? If he's related to Johnny Bravo, the cartoon.
Oh,
what have you been reading, Phil?
Well, I read a short little tale from New Line Cinema's Tales of Terror from 2007. One of them is The Texas Chainsaw Salesman, which is by Peter Milligan and Tom Fester, which I believe did Ex Machina, a bunch of different stuff. And it's basically just a tale about a salesman that goes to the Hewitt Farm. You guys know Texas Chainsaw Massacre at all?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the movies. Yeah, I'm not a fan of the movies at all, but for some reason, I really like it in comics. And this tale he has about a door-to-door salesman. He's selling chainsaws, of course. And he goes up to the Hewitt estate and starts trying to sell his chainsaws to the women there. And they feed him meat, which, of course, is the flesh of humans. But the art is amazing. Do you guys know him at all, this Tom Fester?
No.
No? He's done a lot of Marvel, DC. Like, he's done... You've definitely seen it come across him, I'm sure. Basically, the whole point of the story is how he's complaining that he has no luck selling his chainsaws, but actually he has the luck that he survived because he came pretty close to meeting Leatherface. So it's just a cool little story.
What you been reading, Andrew?
Well, I thought I would cheat a little bit, as is my wont. I'm sure this is a series that probably Steve knows, maybe Kevin. I doubt Phil, given its age. But The Comic Book Makers, Joe Simon with Joe Simon.
What?
Did you ever...
He stopped Kevin, too.
It's a bit of a cheat because it has comics in it, but it's a book. And it's the memoir of Joe Simon.
I don't think I've heard of this.
And it's from 1990. And Steve and I have been going back and forth on all these great, awesome comic book history books that have been coming out. And so I thought I would look this one up because it's by one of the participants. You know, not that that gives him any higher authority, but there is something fun about reading someone who was actually there. Like I said, I'm not saying his is the definitive version, but Joe Simon cast a pretty big shadow over the industry, and he has a way with words. He started out in the Rochester, Syracuse area in newspapers, and then went down to New York City. And he's got some funny stories about, as we intimated in other podcasts, these early comic book companies were total con men, hucksters. And one of the fun ones he writes about is Fox Publications. Victor Fox, who's this kind of crazy caricature. He's the one that called himself the King of Comics. You may have heard stories about that, but there are two funny anecdotes from his time there. One was in the interview process. You know, Victor Fox is huffing and puffing, and he asked for a reference. And so Simon gets a buddy back in the newspaper, back in Syracuse, the Herald, to send down a recommendation, and he sends this glowing recommendation. And now I'll read from the book. It was so complimentary that I was embarrassed and worried that Fox might think it was a fake. They exaggerate, I said, lowering my head to look humble. And so Victor Fox responds, I once knew a whore in Syracuse, Fox continued. People said she was the best whore in town. They didn't impress me. It's a small town. And then the other funny part was, so Simon gets the job, despite, you know, being analogized to the best whore in Syracuse. I spent some time in Syracuse, and I'm more like Victor Fox. But so there's all these, he's running this crazy understaffed, and they're producing comic books. But they have a lot of raw talent people. It's not paying that great, and it's just one headache after the other. And so he mentions one particular terrible mistake, such as 1 week before when an alcoholic letter had made the L run into the I in the title Flick Wilson.
That's why you can't use those words.
And it had been printed that way. So, you know, I like reading about this time when the comics were this crazy fly-by-night business and all these con men and everything were firing up production companies and publishing houses. And I would recommend this read if you like the history. I don't know if it's been discredited or whatever, but I got to think Joe Simon's a pretty square-up guy, at least when he was around, so I'm taking him on his word. Steve, have you heard of this one?
No, I haven't. So you've raised me a Joe Simon history, so I'll have to come up with something to try to match that next time around. Very
cool.
Good.
Well, there's lots of fun anecdotes, but I thought I would share those too.
Sure,
I apologize for their salty nature.
Simon is known to play to the legend, though, at times. Even to go along with a joke or to go along with a story. So you can take that however you want, basically. But even with the Captain America being killed thing, he played along like he was so horrified by it that people thought he was being serious when he was like, that's great, you know, people are calling me about Cap. How cool.
Well, I think you'll like the last page.
He was like,
page.
What, you killed Cap?
the last page is a recollection right from before the book was printed. It came out in 90. In 89, he says Stan Lee called him. And he has a funny story about talking to Stan, like that closes out the book, about how Stan has a bad memory and was calling him to ask him about the old days.
Nice.
And how old he was and what he did and who worked there and everything. But it just made me funny because Stan's like, it didn't seem to me that Martin didn't know I was working there until he met me in the hall one day saying, "What are you doing here?" I've told that story for years. I'd hate to think it's wrong. And then Simon's like, "It was an awfully small office for that to happen, Stan. There must have only been 10 or 12 employees." And it's just kind of funny how he has his take on that whole scene. Sure. And it's not as well publicized to mine as Stan's or any of these other recent ones. But anyways, that's your comic book history segment. Now all you people who only care about new comics can tune back in.
Kevin.
And we'll go to Kevin, who I'm sure has some current.
No, he's got like manga from the 80s.
Oh.
What you got?
Well, bro? Sort of. No. I was. I don't know if I alluded to last week that I was going to talk about Fatale or not, but sometimes it's hard to tell what makes it on there.
Let her rip.
As it were.
Oh, all right. I'll take that. Touche.
But anyhow, you know, that's an Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips, and now Betty Breitweiser production. But the latest arc was this weird. Well, it's a bit of a like noir horror Cthulhu type of book. So the latest arc had the title character, you know, your femme fatale, show up without any memory of what's going on in her life, and she gets involved with a bunch of, I guess, possible rock stars from the grunge era of Seattle, and she just royally messes them up. Because she has these sort of, I don't know, sort of powers where, I don't know if powers is the right word. It's like some kind of weird, like, supernatural type of thing just to mess men up. Where, like, after she's gone, they still, like, pine for her and think about her and basically drive themselves mad. It's like they're at any moment, people could be, like, sticking needles in their eye and, like, gouging their eyes out going, "Oh, man, I gotta figure out the existential angst of the universe." Like, just crazy stuff like that. But it wrapped up really well.
Cool. That arc ended, you said?
Yes, it's I think it's the fourth story arc. I think they're only going maybe 5-6. 24 issues anyways. Yeah, but like the first one was like way back, like in the 40s, something like that, and then there's like these mysterious guys chasing after her. And then she, like, tries to hide away in Hollywood at one point, and of course, someone just happens upon her property, and she can't say no, and then, it, like, things are always just always messing up. And then, within the last year, you had the third arc, which is a bunch of one-shots, which they tackled all these different genres through time. Like, one of them was, like, an Old West tale, one of them was, like, a medieval times type of thing like that. So really interesting through the ages type of horror-ish type of book.
I grabbed the first few issues, but it sort of, I don't know, it didn't strike my fancy. I mean, it looked pretty, and it was a fun book. It just didn't have anything for me.
Yeah, it's just really weird stuff. Like people would try to publish books, but there would be like words in there, like the human mind was not supposed to be able to read, or they would go crazy. So you would have all these like cultists after these people and everything, and then like this book gets published, but like part of it's been cut out, so like people won't be as crazy. Just weird stuff.
Fatale,
enjoyable. Like if you enjoy things just slowly going off the deep end, and you're just like, "What is going on?" Like really creative times for people, but it's like it sort of reminds me of even that. I don't know why I go back to this, like a Deep Space Nine episode where like an alien was influencing like Sisko's kid and. Like, the kid was becoming a better writer, but he was having migraines and he was gonna die, but it was, like, you have to force yourself to a certain point to become, like, that memorable, that good of a writer, like, you would just start going crazy. I guess a certain type of genius is crazy in a certain way.
For some reason, I'm thinking of the old Monty Python sketch with the joke that it's so funny that if you read it or hear it, you know, you'll die laughing. And
yeah.
They had in World War II, and they're, like, converting it to German so that they could yell it across the battlefield and their own soldiers wouldn't be affected.
They had the one, the Twilight Zone rebooted in the 80s. They had one about, there was this, I don't know if it was a joke, but it was something that could be said to you and it would drive you crazy.
You know, that also reminds me of, like, that note, like the sinister note. You better not play that note. That's the devil's note, son. Like back in the 1600s or something.
The quick action. That's you know, or even in, it pops up all the time.
Yeah.
All right, I got one for you. Is a, it's probably about a 12 or 13 inch by 10 inch oversized hardcover graphic novel from Humanoids. And it's even got a nice long bookmark ribbon that I like, and a nice hardcover. But it's not too thick, so it's a nice weighted piece of work here. And it is Muse, and it is by D.P. Filippi, F-I-L-I-P-P-I, and Terry Dodson.
Is this Humanoids? Yeah, this is, must be that European Humanoids.
I love Humanoids books, usually.
Yeah, and this was in some sort of serialized form overseas, because the numbering on the art pages themselves, you know, start over every once in a while, although, you know, there's a printed numbering for the whole graphic novel at the bottom. And it's a little over 100 pages, and it's really fantastic. It's the best stuff I've ever seen from Dodson. And it's shot straight from really tight pencils. And the effect is really cool because it is a Victorian steampunk type mystery fantasy tale. And what's really neat about it is that there are few characters. There's really only four characters in the whole story. So it's really easy to grasp and wrap your head around and kind of just get into the little world and go through the ride and enjoy the story that's being told. There's a little mystery there. What we have is a voluptuous, pretty girl who is coming to be a servant or an assistant at this faraway Victorian steampunky-like mansion where there's all rail cars and cool art and stuff. And there's an assistant and kind of a house chamber maiden lady. And then there's this young girl. And then there's the master of the house. And her job is to keep the master of the house distracted at times from always wanting to, like, build crazy contraptions and reading and just totally losing his humanity to his intellectual ability to create all this crazy stuff. He's got machines that build a treehouse. He's got machines that, you know, clear, that do all the work, wash all the dishes in the kitchen. There's all these little hands. It looks like Mickey Mouse's workshop or something with all the little, you know, hinges and pulleys and everything else. It's really well drawn. And the sketchiness of it being shot right from the pencils isn't too much of an effect. It's not too sketchy, so it's still tight. The female form doesn't look too broken up, which is really nice, and that can happen sometimes when you shoot from Dodson's pencils. But not here. It's oversized, and I think he knew it, so he probably drew this stuff, I would guess, you know, with that in mind. The twist is that the master of the house is a young man, a young lad, if you will. So she's got this boy that she's trying to distract from and try to get to be more of a playful boy and not all into all his mechanical stuff. But he only sees, you know, time as being precious for building and all this sort of business. She keeps getting drugged and then attempted to be drugged. She starts realizing that she's sipping this nectar that's sending her on these trips, and she starts dumping out the liquid so that she can kind of get to the bottom of the mystery. But when she's on her trip, she goes into her a cupboard kind of in her or a wardrobe in her bedroom and goes on these fantastic, like, dream adventures, a pirate thing, another. She's, like, on the, like, practically on the Titanic and is shipwrecked and is dealing with, like, natives. And, you know, it's all done very pin-up girly and glamoury girl kinds of shots. But the technology of the steampunk material is stuff that I hadn't seen from Dodson before. And it all is resolved in a really satisfying way, and I just think it's one of the best quick reads I've had in the last few years.
You know, I think I ordered this and I got canceled, and then I probably ordered it again and I got canceled, and I never got around to it.
It was like for a year it was solicited before it finally hit, but it's really cool, worth checking out.
And is this in that oversized European style format?
Yeah. Yep. Like I said, it's like probably 12 or 13 by 10, 10 wide. So it's a nice big, bigger than a Life magazine kind of thing, or the way the Life magazine used to be, an old Life magazine size.
But you wouldn't want to compare it to some kind of hardcover that you have on your shelf.
It goes on the high shelf with the stuff that the kids won't be able to reach for the longest time. There is some nudity, but it's appreciated when it pops up and not long-lasting.
Yeah, the European comics, you kind of have to expect that, though.
I sent you guys a page of the art just so you could get an idea of what it looked like. What'd you think?
It was nice. It was pretty much what I thought, why I was ordering it in the first place. I'm like, yeah, you know how some of those things seem to work. It's like guys, it seems like they spent the whole year like working on like 64 pages or something like that. So, you know, European stuff is usually really, really nice.
You think you're reading a story that's kind of about one thing, and then it really takes a turn as the mystery goes, and there's missing girls in the town, and there's something funny going on, and she really has to get to the bottom of it, and there's this whole psychedelic angle. There's a story to be told here, too. It's a good read.
And also, I'm glad you sent the image, because it was a little surprising that the machinery works as well. Normally, I prefer more of a colder style, you know, angular and weird gauzes and everything, but the soft rounded edges seems to work well. I mean, obviously the ladies are pretty, but the more the device looks kind of more interesting than I would have thought.
There's a lot less metal and a lot more wood involved in the machinery, so everything has a real earthy feel, so that sketchiness gives it that more organic quality, even though it's mechanical. Phil, you're up.
Probably not, but did you guys ever read any Chaos Comics?
Oh, you sure?
Oh, really?
Nope.
Little Evil Ernie, little Lady Death.
I loved the Lady Death one where her origin, where it was in medieval times. Did you ever read that?
I might have. It's been a long time. Purgatory was from them, wasn't she? With Jim Belent doing the original art on that stuff.
Cremator. I've never read Evil Ernie, though. That's the only one I missed, but I picked up the new Evil Ernie by Dynamite.
Yeah. Any good?
Well, the first issue is, I kind of enjoyed. Like, I've only read about three issues so far, and the first issue is basically Ernie getting the electric chair, and it's kind of intense, but like Andrew said one episode, Dynamite's kind of lazy on their art. I believe you said. Unless I'm misquoting you.
If he doesn't admit to it, I'll admit to saying that.
I was saying that they've made a recent push for a lot of name writers, but they haven't made the same push to get name artists as much. Although the new the Kirby Captain Victory's got some. They are making a bit of a comeback. But yeah, some of the books can be a little rough on the
art. Yeah, because I found after the first issue, like, the art looked just really rushed. And not as nice as the first issue. And after the first issue, Evil Ernie has kind of a new look, which I'm not too fond of, and it's just him basically killing person after person. I didn't really enjoy it too much after that. Like I say, it's my first time reading Evil Ernie, so I don't really have a love for him or anything. I was more of like Lady Death and Cremator fan.
Doesn't have the intellectual depth of Lady Death, I take it.
Oh, some of her comics are pretty good. Like,
when who was the old artist? It was Stephen. I want to say Butler, but it wasn't Butler. What was his name? He was a black guy, and he died way before his time, unfortunately. But he was Stephen Hughes, maybe. But the original artist of the Lady Death stuff, he drew some crazy demon alternate dimension-y kinds of stuff. There was more to that than just TNA. Although there was plenty of that.
The CrossGen series of Lady Death, that was weird, too, like that she showed up there.
Yeah, and then they started giving her actually more of an outfit. Like, it wasn't really a bikini anymore. She became more – it was medieval, I think, Lady Death Medieval it was called.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. And there was even a new series not too long ago by God, I forget what company. I want to say maybe it was Avatar that put it out.
Mm.
Yeah, I've recently seen a Lady Death comic on the stands. I didn't pick it up, but there has been one recently.
I collected that for a bit, and I was really enjoying that too. And it was good art and good story.
Hughes, yeah. I just jumped up and grabbed it off the shelf. Hughes was the Stephen Hughes. Yep.
Yeah, he's great. I didn't know he passed away. That's too bad.
Yeah. That's kind of when the whole original chaos began to start folding there.
Well, okay.
And Pulido was still around and kept it going for a while, but then sold the properties off and then eventually got him back.
That's weird.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, but I guess this didn't do too well at Dynamite because I don't think they've been printing anymore since this first volume.
That seems to happen to quite a few other things anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's fair on most companies.
Yeah.
I think we've mentioned that long runs are few and far between.
Yeah.
Unless you're at Archie.
When we hit Indie Noise 400, finding all the books that are made it to...
We're ripping ourselves off.
I know we're out of order, but I got to jump in that because one of the other books I have is Dynamite series, a Dynamite Entertainment series, and I thought the art was very serviceable and really did the job. It wasn't, like you said, it wasn't a big name artist or anything, but it certainly I was more impressed, and I felt like they were making sure that this series was handled with some of their top guys because it just felt that way when I was reading through, like, that this was a quality product. And what it is it's the Lords of Mars miniseries that was 6 issues written by Arvid Nelson with art by Roberto Castro. And what this is a Edgar Rice Burroughs Chernobyl here. It's Tarzan and Jane get tricked by the Therns on Barsoom on Mars to kind of go through a little portal thing and go to Barsoom, where they encounter the Therns first, who kind of poison their, especially Tarzan's, idea of kind of what's going on Mars, and they set John Carter up to be a despot, and they kill Carter's emissary and his ambassador to the Therns, so that Carter brings his fleet to come down and find out what's going on, and to Tarzan, he doesn't know that there was a death and all the political angle, and he's manipulatable, even though Jane comes around before Tarzan does, but he doesn't believe her, and we get to, Tarzan versus John Carter very briefly, and then it's a big team-up with super-powered, Tarzan, John Carter, and Jane super-powered, all because, Earthmen on Mars... can with a different gravitational pull and forces and all that can leap great feats and do all that kind of stuff. So ended up being a great limited series. All the beats that you would want to get hit. Jane meeting Dejathoris at the end, and Jane becoming like a sharpshooter, and them fighting the big white apes in a big arena, and some cool stuff. I sent you guys a page of this art too, so you could see that it was definitely serviceable.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I love the John Carter universe myself. I even one of the few that enjoyed the movie. And
I, like
I didn't know about this, but oh, really? Oh, that's awesome. I didn't. I know it got a lot of crap, but I thought it was fun.
I love barbarian heroic fictiony kinds of stuff.
Yeah, me too.
And the only thing that I don't really, really love about John Carter's stuff is all the political stuff between Helium and all that sort of business. But that, you know, that's what makes him different than some of the other heroes. But Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, you can't go wrong with his concepts.
Yeah, I didn't know about this miniseries, but it definitely caught my eye now.
Yeah, check it out. It was 6 issues and definitely worth the read, especially to sit down and read it in like 2 sittings or something. So you just go right along with the story. It's fun.
My big problem is Barsoom always sounds like 50s slang for women's breasts or something. Look at the Barsooms on that one. But I have a Dynamite book if we're staying in the Dynamite.
Oh, my God.
Jeez, what is this? I was just going to talk about Flash Gordon because I'm like, they seem to have upped the artistic quality a little bit at Dynamite.
Yeah, yeah. I really think we might look at 2014 as kind of the year they sort of turned the corner with some better stuff. This comes compliments. It was suggested by the Earth 2 podcast. It's another Sherlock Holmes spinoff. This is the second Moriarty-based comic book. There was one from Image a couple years ago. This is Sherlock Holmes, Moriarty Lives. David Liss is the writer. And that name is ringing some bells, but I, of course, didn't bother looking up what I knew him from.
Black Panther.
Ah, there we go.
Illustrated by Daniel Indro. And yeah, and the cover by Francesco Francavilla, who must do like 1,000 covers a month. I love that guy. He's like the hardest working artist in comics.
He's doing a lot of covers for GE because he did the alternate variant covers for the Lords of Mars, too. They all had Alex Ross covers and Francavilla colors. Or covers.
And he does the regular covers for Dark Shadows, which is another Dynamite book.
Do you guys follow him on Twitter? It seems like every day he's posting a cover or a poster or a print or something.
Wow. I will.
Yeah, I really like it. But anyways, this is about, we open at the, you know, at the Reichenbach Falls. Those of you unfamiliar with Sherlock Holmes, although at this point, given the media exposure, are unlikely. But anyways, in the original books, Conan Doyle kills off Sherlock Holmes fighting his nemesis, Professor James Moriarty. But due to the overwhelming demand, he brought the character back because the Strand, I think, was paying him, I don't know, 5 cents a word or 1 cent a word or some outrageous amount for the time. And he's no fool. You know, everyone loves giant piles of cash. So he brought it back. Originally, this was going to be the end where they both go over the falls. But in this case, Moriarty lives and he finds himself washed up in this strange village, and he's like, all right, I'm gonna get my stuff back together. I'm on the run. My network has been dismantled. In the mythology of Sherlock, he had run. He was like, Sherlock was the first consulting detective. He was the first consulting criminal. So he had this whole network of informants and spies, and Sherlock had basically disabled it and put him on the run. So he's like, I'm going to get my stuff back together. And we see he uses the same deduction tricks of Sherlock to get some clothes. And then he ends up in this strange town, and it's a curfew. And he ends up finding the favor of the woman that runs the place. And she ends up getting killed by this Baron character who has seemingly supernatural powers. And it's just an interesting way to twist the guy around because obviously they have to have some reason for him to be a protagonist. So this book provides the motivation because she was nice to him and he took a shine to her and said that he would protect her and was unable to from the Baron. So now he's going to face off against this strange guy with electrical powers. And I really like the artwork. Is got definitely a lot of moody... there's that weird thing where it's kind of the figures, it's a dark book, but the figures are sort of outlined a little bit, which I always like. They kind of makes them pop off the page a little. It's almost like a trace of white kind of around them, or they put the light right around.
Sure.
I'm sure there's some artistic term which I should know for that technique, but it's used to good effect in this one. I mean, some of them don't have a ton of background, but I find the pacing to be good. You know, it sets us up, gives us our motivation for the character, and sets us off, and I'm kind of curious now. Given the fact that it's a short run, I might just trade weight rather than collect the issues. I haven't decided yet. But I did enjoy Sherlock Holmes Moriarty Lives number 1 from Dynamite.
Could someone like me who doesn't know, only knows the basics of the universe, jump into something like that?
Oh, for sure. He lays out in the beginning that he's on the run and he thinks both he and Sherlock probably should have died over the falls. And you get they establish pretty quickly that he's a bad mother. Shut your mouth. Mm-hmm. Just talking about Moriarty type of guy.
Yeah, I read all about that scene in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah, I guess my Shaft reference went unheralded. But
I thought you were going for a Shaft reference there. I was like, yeah, that's probably, yeah.
But I like Daniel Indro. I think his artwork suits. Because, you know, it's a fun time with all the formal wear that they wear at that time. I think it's good for comic books. It's visually interesting. Rather than some of the more modern time when people are just wearing generic, boring-looking clothes.
Yoga pants.
NWO top.
All right, so we shafted over poor Kevin.
Kevin, do you have any Dynamite books?
Sadly, no. That my only Dynamite reference was that whole Flash Gordon thing. which begs the question, would you go see Flash Gordon in the theaters if it was playing right now?
Absolutely.
The Queen one?
The one, what is it, 78?
Yeah. I don't know. I have the DVD, so I...
Oh, okay.
I don't think I would. I am enjoying the... Aren't they doing the Defenders of the Earth book?
Defenders of the Earth.
Which has Flash Gordon in it. Deafening silence reigns.
I don't know.
I'm not familiar. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that's got the... was one of the guys working on the 8 books is the artist on it.
Mark, no, was it Landing? King's Watch?
King's Watch. Sorry. Defenders of the Earth. Defenders of the Earth was the name of the cartoon.
Okay.
It was the spinoff. Originally, they were newspaper characters that were teamed up. It's Mandrake the Magician, Flash Gordon, and the Phantom. And then they had a short-lived cartoon called Defenders of the Earth. And then, obviously, for comic book reasons, Defenders, I think, is a difficult name to get the rights to.
Yeah.
Hence King's Watch. But yeah, I think they're doing that book. Isn't that Dynamite?
Yeah, I think it is. But it's weird because I came in on Flash Gordon with the 90s cartoon. So like Ming the Merciless and everything, like they're like aliens, like sort of like Skrullian green. You know, they really played up rather than being what looks like to be like Chinese or Asian, you know, like aliens, which I find is, I'm like, I guess it was the time, like, that seemed foreign. But anyways, yeah, they ditched that, and then they did in the cartoon, it was like, yeah, they were totally a different culture of aliens and everything, and, you know, I guess the cartoon wasn't successful because it didn't last, but I tuned in every week and said, this is kind of cool. But, like, Flash Gordon was sort of like, you know, a rebellious teenager and stuff like that. And then some other people went along with him. And, you know, he helped them, helped the people rebel against Ming and all that. So that's kind of a weird entry point because now I see everything and I'm like, nothing ever matches up with that cartoon.
Well, maybe you can run down that Defenders of the Earth. I have a feeling it's probably on YouTube or some other site if you like animated Flash Gordon.
I was always more of a Buck Rogers guy.
So, yeah, well, we're doing this recording, and then I'm like, yeah, I could have went to see an Akira Ghost in the Shell back-to-back feature this afternoon, which would have been interesting in theater.
That wouldn't have interfered with your hockey scheduling?
No, see, it was like at 2 o'clock, and I think the other one was at 4:40, so you could just sneak them in before a hockey game, but that would have been a lot for one day.
Isn't Akira like 3 hours?
I don't think so. Maybe 2 hours.
Just feels like 3 hours, Phil. Only joking.
Because I have some, like, I guess passing knowledge with Akira and everything since I read the first volume. It was weird. I found a Barnes & Noble hardcover edition of, like, the first part, and I'm like, what's this doing in Canada?
So how about that comic?
Trying to cover, what?
You were going to talk about a comic, I thought.
Yes. That sort of ties in, you know, Japanese stuff. I've been reading some Japanese stuff. Like some Flowers of Evil. I won't talk about that one. you know how you get stuck in some certain genre tropes or something and you don't really realize?
I know how you get stuck in certain...
Yeah.
I've known you long enough that I know what you do.
Well, you mentioned like Jungle Women or something like that. You know, you're like, oh, that's, yeah, like at some point you sort of realize, you're like, I think I've been reading the same story over and over. So, you know, you get into that certain science fiction type of realm with like Battlestar Galactica where like the Earth has been exploded or, you know, whatever has happened, but we've gotten like space technology. We go off into outer space and then there'll be like some kind of alien race after us, like the Cylons or whatever. Or then, you know, it's usually pretty interesting. Like there was another Japanese series called Tutera where they had like ruined the Earth with like pollution and everything. And then you get your supercomputers working to restore the Earth. And then you're off in outer space and, you know, all this craziness is going on. Or then you're like, oh, well, the Earth should be like this giant preserve, so you have a giant like tech ring like around the planet, and like everyone lives in this ring, which of course leads to class issues and stuff like that. So what always happens is in these ships or the ring around the Earth or whatever vehicle you're using, like you're always going to have problems. Like there's only so many resources. I think even Robotech goes into some of this stuff because it seems like Earth, like on the ship to some degree, but you always have those issues if like ships are trying to transform or something like that. I think even Star Trek Voyager sort of, but that wasn't an interesting like diversion of the concept. I don't think like you sort of run into some good stories, but then you get. It gets kind of boring, and then what they should have done for a year-long story, they'll do for like a two-episode story, and you're like, you know, that would have been interesting if it would have went the whole season. But anyways, the series, Knights of Cydonia. Yes, that is also a song by Muse. I don't know which one came first, but anyhow. Sort of around the same year? It started in 2009 in Japan anyways. But they have this giant ship that has left Earth, but it's, like, attached to, like, an asteroid. Like, that's their sort of, like, resource area. And so then I start wondering if they're going to be mining it or stuff like that. But the series sort of, it doesn't go into certain things. Because you have these aliens that are after you. And they're, it's like a typical war scenario where, like, anything from either side is, like, going to be reverse engineered or studied to, like, better your technology. So you're sending out all these fighter pilots and stuff like that to battle the enemy, but they don't really deal with some of the more serious consequences. Like I guess it's sort of like the bad guys are always shooting, and you're like, when are they going to run out of ammo type of thing? But that's not really the basis of the story. It's like it's more along the lines of cool sci-fi stuff. Like they sort of play homage to that, like Star Wars and trying to destroy the Death Star and stuff like that. Or then they have like this really like sort of slice of life stuff on the ship. So I'm kind of wondering. I'm like, well, what's with the what's the deal with the whole asteroid attached to the ship, or what's the deal with this? Because they even have, like crazy undergrounds. Like, the ship must be, like, hundreds of years old. So it seems like they've just built on top of anything and sort of, like, went outward. So there's, like, crazy catacombs. And, of course, this one guy, like, comes out of the catacombs of the ship. And, like, he's this crazy good test pilot. And you're like, well, that's kind of weird. And then they have more than two genders. So that's just, it really complicates the things to some degree.
Oy vey.
Yeah.
How many volumes is this already?
This is, I think, only 5 volumes. I think the 6th one might have just come out. But I feel like I'm a little ahead of the curve because everything in Japan is like, oh, if it's at least somewhat popular, like, they'll make an anime. Like, Attack on Titan or Flowers of Evil or whatever, like, all of these have an anime, but this one isn't only coming out in, I think, spring of this year, so I'm like, ooh, I'm on the cutting edge.
Speaking of Attack on Titan, did you see the Subaru commercial from Japan? Where no. They show you the giants from the live-action upcoming movie? They look pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think I'm aware of it, but I don't think I've seen it yet. Like, I think
it's worth YouTubing because
I think
they're very unique. Like, it looks just like the comic or the cartoon.
Probably, I might have became aware of it because Leaf Insect Man Dan probably posted that on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's my whole crazy spiel. If you like Robotech, sci-fi, you know. That type of stuff. Or if you find yourself trapped in something you didn't notice that you kept on watching over and over. I just like the idea.
All right, I got one more from Abrams Comic Arts. It is a digest-sized hardcover that came out last year. It is by Daryl Cunningham, both written and drawn. And it's called How to Fake a Moon Landing. Exposing the myths of science denial.
Not so it just sounds the river. Like a Mythbusters episode.
It is, obviously, because it's a one-author thing, and he's in control of the horizontal and the vertical, so to speak. He's leading you to the argument that he wants to make with all of the exposés he's doing here in the different chapters. So there's some straw man arguments in there, but overall I found it to be really entertaining and informative. The chapters are such as the moon hoax, homeopathy, chiropractic, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccination scandal with autism and all that, evolution, fracking, climate change, and science denial overall. And it's all done sequential art, 6 panels to a page, with limited coloring and simple kind of drawings, kind of like you're looking at, Scott McCloud's How to Draw Comics or something like that. It's very clear. And again, he's just trying to give you a visual flow of a way to move through the arguments that he's presenting and the facts that he's presenting on these different issues. And I thought it's a gas and something that'll be fun to reread. And some of the histories of the things like chiropractic, I had no idea where that came from, but pretty funny. Worth checking out. Good old Abrams Comics Arts. Every few episodes I have something from them, it seems, but I'm slowly filling up more and more books on my shelf of their publications.
With your intro, yeah. I wasn't sure if you were going to be like, how dare they? How dare they? Everyone knows the moon landing was fake.
Yeah, or that's obviously a conspiracy where that was meant to happen.
Well, what's fun to read is just what people, what the opposition to some of these things are. Like, oh, that's what, you know what I mean? Like, that's what
I'll list one reason for everything. Everything that's ever happened, it's been aliens.
Yeah, but the chiropractic history is pretty interesting. I was turned on to the Skeptoid podcast, which is one of those skeptical ones, yeah. And they really get into the history of how it's more, now it's come to think of it as muscle and pain relief, but its original theories were much more grandiose and all the ales that could cure everything, you know.
Well, and a neurocalometer that only really measured temperature.
My favorite was the Onion did that. The headline was invents e-meter, which measures human gullibility.
Like a Scientology thing.
But that's not any of our fine Scientology believing listeners. I offer apologies.
I forgot you're in LA.
Yeah, I've been offered several stress tests, and actually they have a center within easy walking distance of where I live. I've had friends go through the pitch, but I never have.
They have a center right across the hall from the chiropractor I used to go to. Got any more comics, Andrew?
Yeah, well, speaking of religion, have you guys heard the good news?
I've heard the word, but that's East of West.
I picked up on a whim Revelations from Boom. Are you guys hear that, that?
That's the Paul Jenkins?
Paul Jenkins, Umberto Ramos.
That's about all I know, I think.
Those are two names that I'm sure most of you are at least familiar with.
Yep, I'm a fan of one of them.
What?
Oh. Uh-oh. Is it Paul Jenkins?
Occasionally, I really like Ramos's pieces, but overall, I really don't like his distorted anatomy stuff. And
I'm not a big fan of him.
And his hands, he makes everybody look like a hobbit or like the old Hank Pym beast.
Yeah.
And
the noses, I don't like his noses.
Occasionally, though, he does some really good looking stuff. And I get it, but most of the time, I don't.
Yeah, you're not gonna like this. This is I would say regular Ramos. So if you don't like him, you are well to steer clear of it, because this is all those things you mentioned about the super cartoony faces and the sort of weird hands. But for some reason, I really like... I'm not sure. I mean, the colors, Leonardo, Olea, and Edgar Delgado, really add a lot to it. I guess I'm not so sure how the breakdown of what he's doing, because there is no other art, you know, there's no anchor or anything. So I'd be curious to see maybe the treatment before the color to see what they add, because I think the color really works in this. This is basically a murder mystery at the Vatican, and we have a generously described lapsed Catholic investigator from London whose childhood friend, is a official at the Vatican, and he ends up asking him to come and investigate this strange murder that happened. A lot of the scenes are in the rain and at night, with kind of all scene also has like a kind of color cast over it in a way. So like the rain one has kind of this bluish gray, and there's a night one in a dungeon that's kind of just dark, and then there's some sort of golden sunlight ones, and it all works kind of interesting, but it's definitely super cartoony. So if you don't like that, avoid it. But I'm kind of curious. Again, this is another one that, because it's one of six, it might read better in trade. But I really found it a neat idea of just a good old investigation. You know, it's a murder mystery where the powers that be don't want him to solve it, but he's a grizzled detective who's going to figure it out. And they've already gone their way, not to directly obfuscate, but certainly to not collect evidence in a timely fashion. And because of the rain and everything, a lot of the stuff is missing. But he makes some important observations, including on the last page, which deepen the mystery.
Mm. Sounds cool.
Sounds like something that Archer Armstrong could be involved in.
There's not really the humor, though. I mean, it's a pretty grit. Like, the guy in the opening, he falls / push / exits via window and ends up on a spiked rail fence,
nice.
Basically getting just about crucified / impaled.
They're going to Hollywood, too.
Yeah, well, Boom is making their presence known. And this is just, I mean, there may be some supernatural or something, but so far it's just a straight crime book, which they have a bunch of. I mean, it may end up being some weird religious angle other than the fact that it's, you know, the Vatican or whatever, but there's nothing mystical or supernatural about this first issue.
Kind of reminds me of how that series, did you ever read The Unknown by Mark Waid from Boom? That was sort of dancing the line between if it was supernatural and you're like, well, what are they going to do here?
That is the one thing with only one issue in my chamber. It's a little, you know, they could really, with one out of six, you know, there's a lot of room for them to go. But I have no reason to think they're suddenly going to get all weird on me. But hey, it's kind
of like a vampire or a zombie's not going to show up in the next issue, and you'd be like, oh man, I didn't want that happening.
Well, there seemed to be some ritualistic nature, perhaps, to the murder, and there's a missing item. So that's why I don't know if they're going to have some, you know, there's like a cult of secret Satanists in the Vatican or something.
Oh, and then then it's a crossover with Fatale, and you're like, ah, oh, damn it, why did they do that?
And some Cthulhu beast jumps out.
Exactly. People are gouging their eyes out with weirdly shaped daggers.
Speaking of Mark Waid doing, like, a hinting on the supernatural kinds of stuff, that was the dance that I enjoyed about those first bunch of issues of that old cross-gen series there that we talked about, that we keep mentioning now and again there, that ruse, Kevin, you know?
Oh, that was so good.
Where it was like the detective didn't believe in anything supernatural, but yet he was getting his skin saved by his assistant, who actually had some supernatural capabilities, and like stuff was happening right under his nose, and pretty. I thought that was kept me coming back each month.
But he did know, that was the thing. I just can't believe they took all that stuff out when they did the second version. I'm just like, I guess that was the spark for me.
Yeah, I liked that. I thought the second one was all. I know everyone was like this. Reboot is horrible trash, and I wouldn't wait.
No,
I liked all the comics.
I enjoyed it. It just lacked.
It was better than nothing, but it wasn't as good as the original.
Yeah,
concept.
That's what I gotta say. Yeah, yeah. The original was probably one of the best comics at the time. Well, considering the era, it had to have been. But or was that? That was 2001, 2000,
around there. Right? I think.
Geis and Perkins were doing the art.
Yeah, because I'm thinking it was probably, because I'm trying to place it with when the Marvel Renaissance happened too. But it was still probably one of the, I would put it up there with that year, with one of the best comics of that year.
Between that and Muse and we're talking all Victorian-ish kinds of books, and Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty, funny.
I broke the format.
It's such a nice visual. Like it, I think it really suits comics because that's fun stuff to look at.
Yep, but you can build a hell of a set when you're just at the drafting table.
Yeah, yeah. But then you gotta draw that. Like you think, oh, you're gonna put all this detail, and then all these,
they're trying to slow down your reading experience. That's all.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm just thinking of all the clothing, and the artist is like if you had just had regular clothing, then it would be like, oh, you could have finished that like page in a day. But now it's like, oh, I got to do all this extra elaborate detail. It's sort of like they were Jason Wood was talking on 11 o'clock comics with Deadly Class. It's like, yeah, there's like this woman that's all tattooed up, and it's like, yeah, now the artist is going to have to draw that every issue. It's like, yeah, it's cool, but, oh, man, like, burning the midnight oil there at 3 a.m., they must be going, when did I ever agree to do this?
Got a last book for us, Kevin?
No, I think I'm good. I gotta get to the game.
All right, Kevin's got to go play hockey. So be it. That's what they do up north.
Or watch hockey. Those are the two things.
See you next time.
Thanks.
He was born in Big Beaver by the borderline. He started playing hockey by the time he was 9. His dad took the hose and froze the backyard. Little buddy dreamed he was Rocket Richard. He grew up big and he grew up tough. He saw himself scoring for the Wings or Canucks, but he wasn't that good with a puck. Buddy's real talent was beating people up. His heart wasn't in it, but the crowd ate it up. Through Pee-wee's
babies and juniors and midgets and mites. He must have racked up more than 300 fights, till a scout from the Flames came down from Saskatoon. Said there's always room on our team for a goon. Son, we've always got room for a goon. There were Swedes to the left of him, Russians to the right, a Czech at the blue line looking for a fight. Brains over brawn, that might work for you. What's a Canadian farm boy to do?
Hit somebody!
What else can a farm boy from Canada do?
Hit somebody!
What's a Canadian farm boy to do?
Hit somebody!
What else can a farm boy from Canada do? Hit somebody was what the crowd roared when Buddy the Goon came over the boards. Coach, he'd say, I wanna score goals. The coach said, Buddy, remember your role. The best guys get paid, they shoot and they score. Protect them, Buddy, that's all what you're here for. Protection is what you're here for. Protection, it's the stars who score. Protection, go and kick somebody's ass. Protection, don't put the biscuit in the basket, just hit somebody. It rang in his ears, blood on the ice ran down through the years. The king of the goons with a box for a throw, a thousand stitches and broken bones. He never lost a fight on his icy patrol, but deep inside, Buddy only dreamed of a goal. He just wanted one damn goal. There were Swedes at the blue line, Finns at the red, a Russian with a stick heading straight for his head. Brains over brawn, that might work for you. What's a Canadian farm boy to do?
Hit somebody!
What else can a farm boy from Canada do?
Hit somebody!
What's a Canadian farm boy to do?
Hit somebody!
What else can a farm boy from Canada do? In his final season, on his final night, Buddy and a Finn goon were pegged for a fight. 30 seconds left, the puck took a roll, and suddenly Buddy had a shot on goal. The goalie committed, but he picked his spot. 20 years of waiting went into that shot. The fans jumped up, and the Finn jumped too. And cold cock Buddy on his follow through. The big man crumbled, but he felt alright, 'cause the last thing he saw was the flashing red light. He saw that heavenly light. There were Swedes to the left of him, Russians to the right, a check at the blue line looking for a fight. Take care of your teeth, that might work for you. What's a Canadian farm boy to do?